Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to the success of Florida's $62.4 billion hospitality industry, whose members provide close to 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, on the web at frla.org. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Silver Airways, serving as the United Continental Connection, providing daily direct service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Fort Lauderdale, with connections to the Bahamas. FlyTallahassee.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
An amendment added onto the so-called parent trigger bill could put the safety back on the trigger option when it comes to failing public schools.
Well, with this amendment, parents are essentially told you can have a seat at the table, but you don't have anything to leverage for your voice to be heard.
Also tonight, Governor Scott signs a bill making it much easier for children in foster care to do everyday things like perform in plays and go to the movies.
You don't want the words foster care stamped on your head. You don't want to be a foster care kid. You just want to be a regular kid, and this bill will help you do that.
We'll also watch the Florida House go nuclear and also go for a run through the capital city. I'm Tom Flanagan, and welcome to Capitol Report. The controversial parent trigger, known by some as the Parent Empowerment Bill, cleared its final committee in the Florida Senate today. But that wasn't before the discussion grew more impassioned and the issue itself a bit more complex. That's because of an amendment that attached itself to the bill in the committee. Bill opponents say that amendment makes the measure more to their liking, but Lynn Hatter reports the change may also have watered the bill down, infuriating supporters of the original legislation.
The Senate version of the proposal was amended to bring it more in line with the variation that's already cleared the Florida House. But an additional amendment by Republican Senator David Simmons of Maitland goes further. Simmons's amendment takes away the ability of the appointed State Board of Education to have final say on turnaround options for failing schools.
We have said that this will be a local decision here.
Simmons says the amendment is aimed at keeping and enforcing local control, as well as holding both school districts and parents accountable for the outcome of school performance.
The parents are as culpable as the school board. The parents are the ones who have not caused the involvement or had the involvement to cause their children to do well in that school. At the same time, many of them are in poverty. As a matter of fact, all of them are in poverty in these cases, and therefore the school district has an extra lift that it must make.
Under the original version of the bill, parents with kids in a failing school could petition a school district to implement one of five federally mandated school improvement options, such as closure, conversion to a charter school, or the overhauling of the administration. If local school boards didn't agree with the parents' recommendation, they could submit their own plan. The State Board of Education would then decide. Local school districts derided that as a loss of local control, and Simmons's amendment removes the state board from the picture. The amendment also marks a small victory for bill opponents, who worry parents could be swindled into the conversion option by greedy for-profit charter school operators. But it doesn't mean they're okay with the rest of the bill, and many of the same parent and teacher groups who have been in opposition continue to oppose the measure, even though those like Don Stewart with the Florida PTA thanked Simmons for the amendment.
But I want to thank Senator Stargell and Senator Simmons for trying to make this bill a little better. Now, I usually teach my parents it's really hard to make a bad bill better, but PTA is going to have to still oppose the overall trigger bill because there's just a lot of what-ifs.
The bill's sponsor, Republican Kelly Stargell of Lakeland, says she's willing to keep the amendment in the bill, but only on certain conditions.
And in doing this, we'll have some understanding that we all are in agreement that we want to do something as a state to intervene on these failing schools and to help these kids who are attending these parent failing schools and give these parents a say. then with that, I'll cautiously say we can support this today, knowing that we will continue to work on this, and it's not a set-in-stone deal.
Simmons' amendment basically neuters the trigger part of the bill, and groups that have backed the proposal, such as the pro-school choice group, the Foundation for Florida's Future, created by former Governor Jeb Bush, aren't pleased. Allison Abouchon is the foundation's spokeswoman.
Well, with this amendment, parents are essentially told you can have a seat at the table, but you don't have anything to leverage for your voice to be heard.
Democrats on the committee supported the amendment, but in the end voted against the entire bill. Still, with the new language giving school districts final say, some Democrats say they could support the proposal if the amendment language stays intact. But that could be difficult. A version of the parent trigger bill has already cleared the full House of Representatives, and the amendment may not stay in place if it's sent back to the chamber. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Normalcy Bill is a nickname for the legislation Governor Rick Scott signed into law today. Jessica Palumbo reports children's advocates are celebrating the new law they say will give the state's more than 7,000 foster children lives like any other child.
For children who live in foster care, the state of Florida has a say in even the most trivial parts of their lives. Former foster child Emmanuel Oliver from Palm Beach County remembers what it was like when he was in high school and he wanted to see movies at the theater with his friends.
I would have to get court orders. Then you get in court orders and you have to wait for those court orders. Then it takes forever.
So yeah. You have to like look at the movies for like a month away and decide what movie that you want.
Right. And then the movies could be out of the movie theaters because you have to wait for all that.
It's not just movies. Measures that were meant to keep kids safe ended up keeping them from going on school trips, performing in plays, and going with their families to beaches outside their counties. But that's all about to change with the law that goes into effect on July 1st.
I've heard this bill can be called many different names, from the Quality Parenting Act to the Permission to Parent Act. However, I think the right title should be the Let Kids Be Kids Bill.
Yeah!
That's Florida Governor Rick Scott in front of the Capitol Thursday morning. It's one of the first bills he's signing this session, and he held a ceremony surrounded by children's advocates and foster families.
Florida's children today are leaders of tomorrow, and those in foster care should be given every opportunity that those not in foster care are given.
The bill allows Florida's more than 4,000 foster parents to make decisions that would have required state approval before. Because of the restrictions, it's estimated only 3% of 18-year-old foster children have a driver's license. But Scott says he expects that percentage to rise.
Now, I remember when my first daughter learned to drive, I wanted to get out of the car.
I think you did.
I did. But this new law will allow foster parents to teach their kids how to drive a car, I wish them a lot of luck, and prepare them for their future.
As Scott signed the bill, Victoria Jackson couldn't hold back her tears.
It's crazy that we have walked these halls, and I mean the hard work and the effort that so many of us have put into this bill, getting signed, it paid off.
Jackson is with the group Florida Youth Shine, a statewide network of former foster children who advocate to make life better for those still in the system. Jackson says it's taken 3 years to get this bill passed, and it didn't seem real until just now.
And this morning when I'm actually hearing the words and I'm looking at the folder with the markers and Rick Scott, it's humbling. It's like, wow.
Monice Jackson is another Youth Shine advocate and former foster child from Tallahassee.
And after this bill, I won't have to worry about my brothers and sisters now in care because they have the opportunity to do everything that any normal child does, going to the park or walking down the street with your best friend or can I walk to school instead of taking the bus? It's a beautiful day, but, you know, you couldn't do those things before then. And today it's just changing.
Senator Nancy Dietert, a Republican from Venice, sponsored the bill. She says the best ideas come from the bottom, not the top. She gives credit to advocates from the Guardian Ad Litem program and Youth Shine.
You don't want the words foster care stamped on your head. You don't want to be a foster care kid. You just want to be a regular kid, and this bill will help you do that.
Now you're going to make me cry.
That's the bill's House sponsor, Representative Ben Albritton, a Republican from Bartow.
Kids in the foster care system, not anymore.
Yeah.
Not anymore. Today is the beginning of a new day. It's the beginning of a new freedom and a new opportunity for kids to be able to live their lives to the maximum.
Florida has almost 8,000 children living as wards of the state in the foster care system. More than 5,500 are living with foster parents. And Florida First Lady Ann Scott hopes to see more.
The sacrifices foster parents make are great, but the rewards are even greater. And I encourage more Floridians to consider sharing their homes and their hearts with children in need.
Information on the foster care system can be found online at fosteringflorida.com. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, a bill to make it easier for former inmates to reenter society went through some significant changes today, a move that took the bill's sponsor by surprise.
Unfortunately, after reading this, it pretty much guts the major intent of the bill, so obviously I'd have to view it as an unfriendly amendment.
Some say it's time to do away with a rule that lets utilities charge customers for nuclear plants that may never be built, but others worry without it, Florida may not have access to nuclear power.
I still believe that harnessing the power of the atom is one of the greatest advances mankind has made.
And a national nuclear energy expert thinks the Florida legislature may not be doing enough to protect consumers.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org.
The Senate version of an inmate reentry bill looks a little different now. In some Florida lawmakers' own words, it was essentially gutted at its second committee stop today, a move that even took the bill's sponsor by surprise. As Sasha Cordner reports, while the measure still cleared a criminal justice budget panel, it wound up pitting Republicans against Republicans.
It was Republican versus Republican in the Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Subcommittee Thursday when it came to vetting an inmate reentry bill sponsored by Republican Senator Thad Altman. The so-called Smart Justice Bill allows for the state to provide identification cards for these inmates free of charge. That's been touted as one of the major problems facing former inmates when they're released from prison. It also encourages the department to develop faith and character-based programs to help the inmates. And before Thursday's committee meeting, the bill had already gone through some changes. That included eliminating a provision that the Florida Department of Corrections create reentry facilities. Another provision allowed the department to establish incentives for the reentry program to promote participation by private sector employees, a matter of serious concern for correctional employee unions.
We have changed that to provide for in-prison treatment followed by community treatment and supervision for nonviolent offenders. Again, this is to help in the reentry process. It leaves up to the department how best to deliver the in-prison treatment. The past bill, we eliminated the language that gave preference to certain providers.
Still, that did not stop the panel's chair, Republican Senator Rob Bradley, from adding two amendments that would more than cut the already watered-down bill in half.
I think that the best way to move Senator Altman's bill forward is to scale it back and focus on those things that have an opportunity for passage on the full floor.
So what does the bill look like now? Some Republicans, like Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla, had that question on their minds for Senator Bradley.
So with your amendment, you're taking out, Senator Bradley, pretty much most of the bill. What stays in it?
The ID portion.
So,
well, there's two amendments. Yes, that's my intention, to take out most of the bill with the exception of the ID.
And so when you take this amendment and the next one, basically the only thing that's left is the ID portion?
And the faith and character-based.
What was taken out included a provision that made sure every inmate had the skills and training needed to go back out into society within 2 years of their upcoming release. There was also a provision that could allow an eligible nonviolent offender to have a split sentence, like allowing the inmate to perform community service in the last year of their sentence. Today, Florida inmates are required to serve 85% of their sentence. But the bill's sponsor, Senator Altman, did not appear to approve of the changes. While Altman admits he and Bradley had a brief conversation about the amendments, he says he did not see them because there was a glitch in the system. Having seen the amendments now, Altman says he feels like the essence of the bill is gone.
Unfortunately, after reading this, it pretty much guts the major intent of the bill, so obviously I would have to view it as an unfriendly amendment.
Later, Altman reluctantly agreed to the amendments to move the bill along with the condition that he speak to Senator Bradley following the meeting. And so the bill passed unanimously 13-0 out of the Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Subcommittee Thursday. It has one more stop to go before it heads to the Senate floor. Meanwhile, this could set up a battle over in the House after the measure's House companion has not been amended to reflect these recent changes. The bill, sponsored by Republican Representative Dennis Baxley of Ocala, has already passed its only committee, the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee, a panel Baxley chairs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida's nuclear cost recovery program is a controversial one. It lets power companies charge customers for the cost of a nuclear plant before that plant is even built. And in a number of cases, companies have been charging customers for years with no sign of an end in sight. Regan McCarthy reports that's led some to question whether the companies will ever build the plants. It's also led to lawmakers proposing some new rules to ensure customers get what they're paying for someday.
Plans are underway to build a few different nuclear power plants in the state of Florida. But recently, a number of lawmakers have begun raising concerns that utility companies are charging customers for those power plants without making much forward progress when it comes to actually building them. The companies explain that getting the proper permits and getting ready to start building the nuclear plant takes time. But others are questioning whether the companies intend to build the plants at all. And some residents and business owners say they're tired of paying for them, like Mary Wilkerson, who owns Gulfside Resorts in Indian Rocks Beach.
We see our utilities as an important partner in our success. But any time we pick partners in our business, and we've been in business for 25 years, our first rule of thumb is to pick a partner with skin in the game. It's the first thing we look at. What do they have to lose? And when the legislature passed advanced cost recovery, they shifted all of that risk from the utility shareholders to customers like me.
Wilkerson says it seems to her that utility companies are doing their job for their shareholders, but she questions who's looking out for her.
From what I can tell, I don't feel the PSC, with all due respect, has always has my back and are always acting in the public's best interest.
Now, a bill under consideration in the House aims to strike a balance between keeping nuclear power as a part of the state's available energy sources and making sure customers aren't being taken advantage of. Representative Jose Diaz, a Republican from Miami, presented the bill in the House Energy and Utility Committee. He says the House version of the bill and Senate version differ in a few places.
We are asking for a sunset date 12 years into the future, while our counterparts are asking for 20 years in the future. We are asking for an intermediary review, which they're not asking for, with the things that we're asking for. So there are things in this bill that are dramatic, that are what the consumers have been asking for. They're the things that I've been receiving emails about making sure there's some accountability in the process, making sure there's a date certain when this project will be complete so that people don't feel they're throwing their money into an abyss.
But Representative Clay Ingram, a Republican from Pensacola, says while he does understand there are issues with the regulation of the state's nuclear cost recovery law as it stands now, he doesn't think doing things that could put roadblocks up for future nuclear power projects is a good idea.
I still believe that harnessing the power of the atom is one of the greatest advances mankind has made, and I don't want to abandon that ability to use nuclear power in the future. I think it still is got to be, will be one day, a huge part of our energy portfolio.
On the other side of the argument is Representative Dwight Dudley, who isn't a member of the committee that considered the bill Thursday, but was given a chance to debate during the meeting. In Dudley's words, the nuclear cost recovery law puts a gun to customers' heads.
We as Americans say we believe in the free enterprise system. We believe in free markets. We are picking winners and losers here. We are funding a technology that is apparently not well received on Wall Street.
Representative Michelle Raywinkle-Vasalinda, a Democrat from Tallahassee, voiced similar concerns. She's sponsoring a measure that would do away with the state's nuclear cost recovery law completely. But the bill's sponsor, Representative Diaz, says the fact that neither side is happy with the bill could be a good sign.
We're seeing the investor-owned utilities coming up and saying they don't like the bill. And we're having the folks that want to repeal this language saying that they don't like the bill. And I think that shows that we're actually making progress.
The measure passed out of the committee. Meanwhile, a similar bill in the Senate is awaiting its second committee hearing. Representative Raywinkle-Vasalinda's repeal proposal has not yet been heard. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
As we just heard from Regan McCarthy, Florida House members were delving into the intricacies of nuclear cost recovery today. One man who thinks that discussion is long overdue is Peter Bradford.
Well, Florida is in the unique situation of being the only state in the country where customers are paying for nuclear plants that don't even have construction permits from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Bradford is a former member of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and once chaired the utility commissions in Maine and New York. He says when most of the country's nuclear plants were being built back in the 1970s and 80s, many states allowed utilities to charge their customers the construction costs up front.
Those laws and policies, though, normally had some safeguards in them that Florida's 2006 law doesn't have. For example, they put a cap on the total amount that could be charged. They perhaps provided that the charges couldn't begin until the plant was under construction or 50% complete or within 3 years of completion.
Bradford applauds the Florida legislature trying to tighten up the rules for when utilities can charge customers for nuclear plants yet to be built.
Legislative amendments would require at least a more rigorous cost-effectiveness test than has been administered in the past.
But he doesn't think what's proposed goes far enough to protect utility customers' wallets.
I mean, you can see it most clearly at the Crystal River nuclear plant, where customers paid tens of millions of dollars to increase the output of that plant, and then Progress, now Duke Energy, broke it in the course of trying to do the uprate. They can't fix it. They've announced they're going to close it permanently, and those tens of millions of dollars are just gone.
Bradford says he has no knee-jerk objection to nuclear power and believes it has its place in the nation's energy mix. Still, he thinks there's a better energy option for Florida utilities than to keep planning and charging customers for nuclear plants that may never be built.
Indicate that Florida has a need for X thousand megawatts of capacity over the next 10 years and find out who's willing to bid what in order to meet that need. And almost uniformly, where states and regions have run auctions like that, the surprises have tended to be pleasant ones. They've gotten more capacity bid than they needed. It's diverse, and it's considerably less expensive than new nuclear.
All of this, Bradford says, he'll be sharing with a number of people during his visit in Tallahassee.
Some legislators, some state officials, and a gathering of customer groups.
Those meetings expected to last all day Friday. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. And now here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at what's coming up at the Capitol tomorrow.
Friday morning at 9, the EDR Revenue Estimating Conference meets. Among the issues, House Bill 1061 that revises provisions for enforcement of traffic control signals using red light cameras. It would require traffic control signals to maintain certain signal intervals and display a duration based on the posted speed, and revising provisions for hearings. Also to be considered are bills dealing with disposition of unclaimed property, growth management, and eminent domain proceedings. The House goes into session at 10:30 Friday morning for bills in second reading, and although the calendar says until completion, the session is expected to end early so lawmakers can make early flights home. Those are a few of the items on tomorrow's legislative agenda. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Florida Governor Rick Scott ran nearly 2 miles to the state capitol building this morning to start the yearly law enforcement torch run to benefit the Special Olympics. Thomas Andrew Gustafson was among those awaiting the governor and hundreds of other runners, which included Attorney General Pam Bondi, other high-ranking politicos, law officers, and Special Olympics athletes.
Good morning!
It's a dreary, drizzly day, but the bright colored shirts, the cheering, and the speeches of camaraderie, hard work, and jobs well done create some sunshine on the back steps of the old Capitol building. It's the start of the 30th annual law enforcement torch run benefiting the Special Olympics, and Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi is welcoming the crowd.
Each year since 1984, city, county, state, federal law enforcement officers and our great correctional officers and staff carried the flame of hope into the stadium at the opening ceremonies of the annual Florida State Summer Games in May.
The torch run actually began an hour before the big event at the Capitol. Florida Governor Rick Scott, along with other runners, covered the first 2 miles of the 1,500-mile run across the state of Florida, running from a nearby Publix, the largest sponsor of the run, to the Capitol. Governor Scott thanked law enforcers and went on to explain how his 2013 budget will help those with disabilities.
My budget has $36 million to provide critical services to people who are on the Agency for Persons with Disabilities waiting list, which means that hundreds of families who need support will get it. On top of that, another $2.5 million for job services.
Throughout the event, many speakers, from Tallahassee Mayor John Marks to Florida Secretary of Education Tony Bennett and Secretary of Corrections Mike Cruz, talked about their pride in the athletes and law enforcement. Attorney General Bondi says it's the largest grassroots fundraiser in the nation, and President of the Florida Special Olympics, Sherry Wheelock, explained the importance of what's happening.
The torch run isn't just an event, but it's part of a larger movement across the world to bring tolerance and acceptance and inclusion, and the law enforcement is making a huge impact. At each leg of the way, we're supporting our athletes not only from a fundraising perspective, but also bringing awareness to their abilities and to what they can bring to our community.
The funds for the Florida Special Olympics are raised through both torch run shirts and hats, along with special events that will be taking place throughout the state as the run continues until the Summer Games in May. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Thomas Andrew Gustafson.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank, Thomas Andrew Gustafson, and Stephen Rodriguez. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2013 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to the success of Florida's $62.4 billion hospitality industry, whose members provide close to 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, on the web at frla.org. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Silver Airways, serving as the United Continental Connection, providing daily direct service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Fort Lauderdale with connections to the Bahamas. FlyTallahassee.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.